Welcome to the Invest with Clarity podcast, where you will learn how success in investing, as in life, is the result of absolute clarity. Mark Pearson of Nepsis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, shares his passion for portfolio management and commitment to transparency and communication to allow investors to fully understand what they own and why, bringing them to clarity in their investments. And now, here are your co-hosts, Matt Halloran and Mark Pearson.
Hello and welcome to another Invest with Clarity podcast. I'm your host, Matt Halloran, joined always by Chuck and Mark. Today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite words ever, which is conundrum. So today, Chuck is going to open this puppy up with the indexing conundrum. Now, if you don't know what that means, well, just stay tuned because Chuck's about to give you a definition. Chuck, take it away.
Oh, Matt, thank you, my friend. I think we got a really, really good one. How do you like that for being redundant? Anytime you start off with a word like conundrum, you got to go to the dictionary.com, right? To give a kind of a little background on this. Actually, some words in the English language have two definitions attached to them. There's the primary, right, and the secondary. So I'm going to read directly from the Orthodox Dictionary. So a conundrum is a confusing and difficult problem or question. But here's the play on this. The conundrum secondary definition says this: a question asked for amusement, typically one with a pun in its answer or a riddle. So the reason that I titled this, because I know it raises Mark's ire, and it's a question asked for amusement, right? Is there really a conundrum in indexing? Is there a difficult problem, whether we should use it or not? I think that's the amusement part. But I wanted to delve into the issue with indexing and how it's really reared its ugly head here in 2023. So, Mark, I'd like to just rattle off a couple of things here, too. And I want to get your comment on this. I know we've done some podcasts right on indexing before, and I think we've covered from a broad aspect. But what I really want to dig into is I want to dig into how several stocks have driven what appears to be the overall market, right? Which I know you and I loathe using that term, but which is called the overall market of stocks. So I'm going to give you some numbers here, Mark, and I want you to comment on this. So through last week, this was through June 6th, for 2023, the year-to-date return on the S&P 500 was 9.2%. I think we're closer to 12 now. We picked up a little steam here. But Mark, here's the main one. 95.6% of that return has been garnered by the top 10 stocks as a percentage. Now, yeah. You and I, here's one thing I can tell you. You and I always quote 1999, right?
Yes.
And we had 54.5% of the stocks in 1999 garnering the return. So just think about that. That's almost double. It's just incredible. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and take it away, my friend. I think you got to have some really good comments on this.
Well, I appreciate it. First of all, foundationally speaking, to get back to Nepsis, what does Nepsis mean? To be watchful, alert, and vigilant with a clear and sober mind against illusions and fear, thus allowing one to obtain ultimate clarity. People get fearful when, quote unquote, the markets are down. And they don't get fearful when the markets are up. But as part of the, quote unquote, markets going up, investors don't know what causes the indexes or the returns to go up. And let me just say bluntly that it is just as dangerous. In fact, I would argue it's more dangerous not to know why your portfolio is going up than it is to know why it's going down. Now, you may ask yourself, that's impossible. Why wouldn't I want to know that? Because for planning purposes, you're going to base your planning based on the value of your assets and a historical average of what you think that rate of return is going to be going forward. if your portfolio over a short period, or even let's call it a year, 2 years, has done extremely well, and it's been driven by two or three stocks, don't you think you should know that? Because just as those two or three stocks go down, it could have just as bad of an impact as it has a good impact going up. When markets are going down and the value of companies are going down, planning wise, it's always a little bit more conservative or easier, because you believe and realize that over time, if you know which companies are down and why, you can buy more of those companies on sale. And frankly, I'd feel better about my planning in a down portfolio than an up portfolio. Now, all that being said, back in 1999, when the S&P was trading at about 26 times earnings on average, and it was the top 10 holdings were driving over 50% of the return, hindsight's always 20/20. After the crash, everybody came out and said, well, this is why it happened. All these stocks were going through the roof, and the majority of the S&P was being driven by 6 to 10 stocks. We're now in that exact same boat, and nobody is really, they're talking about it, but they're saying it's no real fear because, you know, the markets are trading, you know, the top 10 holdings, I mean, they're trading at 24, 25, 26 times earnings. Now that can go on for a while, but if you don't know what's driving your portfolio performance, you don't know what businesses are doing it, I would argue that having that lack of clarity could provide a significant level of a disadvantage to you going forward in terms of your portfolio.
Exceptionally well said. And let's maybe unravel the onion piece, if you will, about how indexes are constructed. I think if you were to ask, right, the everyday person walking on the street, or even an investor who's been involved for decades, what is the S&P comprised of? Well, S&P 500, that must mean 500 stocks. Okay, got that. How do they determine what the average is? I think most people, Mark, would say we take 500 stocks, you equally weight them, you add them up, and that whatever that return is, you divide by the respective time frame. That isn't how it works.
No.
The world, right, ever since we knew it, and this goes really back to the price weighting scheme of the Dow back a century ago, this market cap weighting phenomenon was born. I'd like you to explain a little bit about, to our listeners, what market cap weighted is versus equally weighted. And I'm going to give you some statistics about how skewed that is this year performance-wise.
Sure. First of all, the problem with, so market cap weighted means that the larger the company is, the more value it is given to the return of the S&P 500.
Exactly.
So the bigger get bigger and they impact the index. And the problem with this, here's the problem when the industry focuses on indexing. People are going to look at their portfolios, 99, unless they have 100% of their money in the S&P 500, and nobody should have 100% of their money in the S&P 500.
Right.
And everybody's going to look at their portfolio and go, holy crap, my portfolio is not performing nearly as well as the S&P 500. And they are going to emotionally want to buy more of the S&P 500, which then makes the S&P go parabolic on a value basis, because everyone wants to pour in the S&P because their portfolios are not performing nearly as well. But the reality of that is an artificial number that is skewed. That is not how the majority of portfolios, and frankly, the majority of companies are doing. Frankly, two of the names in that top 10 name are driving probably even half of the 95.5%, which even gets more crazy when you look at a name like an NVIDIA or a name like Microsoft. I don't know who else is besides NVIDIA. It's got to be a Microsoft.
Yeah, or a Tesla, or even Meta, year to date, at least year to date.
Those three. Yep.
Yeah.
So it gives people a false sense sense of reality, folks. This is why you can't benchmark to an index over shorter periods of time. It's fool's gold. You're going to end up making poor decisions.
Can I ask you guys a quick question here? Because with what you just said, as a general schmuck who lives on the street here, right? I mean, I have a home, but you know what I mean? I'm just a regular guy, right? What happens if NVIDIA crashes? What happens to the S&P if Microsoft goes down 50%? How is that realized within the S&P? I'm sorry, I'm not trying to get you guys off, but Mark, you just dropped some numbers there. And that now I'm just thinking to myself, well, gosh, there have been larger things that have fallen. What would happen in that situation?
Well, it's hard to say. I'll go first, and Chuck, you can opine here. Yep. Let's go back to 1999 into 2000, when it all peaked. And over the next 3 years, the S&P, now, granted, some of that was driven by 9/11, but the S&P from peak to trough, I believe, was down 52%. Is my memory served me right there, Chuck?
Pretty close. It was in the 45%, but that's okay. 52 was the great financial crisis.
Yeah. Okay. So in the 40s. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say what would happen with NVIDIA. And you actually bring up a great point, Matt, because no one really knows when evaluation reverts to the mean. And everyone's talking about how great the performance of NVIDIA has been this year. And frankly, over the last 12 months, which I think over the last 12 months, it's up about 160-180%, something of that nature. But you have to remember that in 2022, that stock was down over 50% at that time. And of course, the S&P at peak to trough was down, I think, about 32%.
You got it.
Yeah. So the reality is the impact that it could have, a dramatic impact on the S&P. Now, other stocks were down too, like Google, Microsoft, and the such. However, it can have an impact on the markets. And actually, let me just finish with this point, Matt. There seems to be a ground swirl, and Chuck, you can opine on this piece also. There seems to be a ground swirl about the index committee, the people who run the indexing, putting more focus on an equal weighted index for that exact reason, that when you get these great returns, they're skewed by 10 names, and that can impact an investor's investment decision-making process, which short-term may be okay, but long-term is not, which is why you've got to have a buy discipline, a sell discipline, and why asset allocation is so important. And I would argue our performance over the S&P 500 has been extremely strong. And it hasn't been until this quarter in 2023 that I've actually bought one of those top five names, Google, for portfolios. We used to own NVIDIA. We sold NVIDIA a while back to buy AMD, which actually turned out to be a pretty dang good move on its own. But the point to be, you can get great performance if you have the right process in place and not have to rely on any one company or any three companies to drive your overall performance. But again, know what you own and why you own it.
Mark, I think you brought up a great point on Matt's question about equally weighted, which maybe take a step back. I'll try to put some color to that versus market cap. So as you said, market cap's determined by size, which is a simple formula. It's shares outstanding times the price of the given company. So under that definition, when you have 500 companies, you simply stack rank those 500 by size. So NVIDIA, Apple, Tesla, and the like, Apple's the world's largest company, approaching, I think, $3 trillion of market cap. When you think about what the 500th stock in the S&P has as a percent of ownership within the index, and even if the performance is good, bad, or indifferent, it doesn't matter. But let's say whatever that 500th company is, if you had a deep conviction in it and you wanted to own it and you wanted to put it into your portfolio at kind of an equally weighting with inside your model, that's a much different aspect of investing than burying it in some index where it has no consequence on the returns whatsoever. Speak about how an investor should view that difference between that equally weighted or starting out and choosing a company irrespective of its size.
So we used to do portfolio analysis. We would do these deep analysis into showing people how many companies they owned in their portfolio. And then we would show them what the top three holdings as a percentage of their portfolio made. And it was usually 1% to 2% of the total portfolio, top three holdings. And to me, that's not investing. That's just cookie cutter. And if I own 500 names, basically the S&P 500 is telling you what the deepest conviction stocks are based on the market cap, but they may not be the best performing stocks. And there's a lot of companies that are in the S&P 500. Take a name like an AMD, take a name like a Shopify, take a name like some of the other chip names that are out there.
Qualcomm. Some of
Qualcomm is another one. These are companies that have had very good performance, but because of their size, they don't have the impact on the index, but they can have an impact on a portfolio. This is why we're huge proponents of what they call the SMA model, separately managed account model, where you can have a more equally weighted or a more balanced portfolio of your top 30 conviction companies that you want to own within that portfolio. And so indexing limits clarity, limits flexibility, puts you in a situation of biases that you're not even aware of, which therefore means you don't understand or know what the potential risks are of that allocation and that index in the future as you're trying to do your financial planning. This is why we believe knowing what you own, what the percentage of it is in your portfolio, gives you a much higher level of clarity and a much higher level of confidence in the overall long-term balance and valuation metrics of your portfolio.
Excellent. I'm going to shift gears here a little. And Matt, I want you to jump into this because I'm asking this blanket question. There's not a right or wrong answer here. Just maybe give your opinion. And Mark, I want you to speak to our process. So I found really a nugget that I want to unearth where you take the five largest companies by index weight, and you compare that to their contribution based on net income to the overall index. So I'm going to give some names and I'll give you these. And Matt, I want you to take a guess at which one do you think maybe Nepsis would own, and then Mark speak to the recent purchase and et cetera. So Apple has a 7.5% weighting in the index, yet its contribution to the S&P 500 is 5% when you look at net income. That's projected in 2024. Microsoft, number two, 6.7% in the index. Its income contribution, 4.1. Google, which is now known as Alphabet, 4% in the index, but 4% identically as income. Amazon, 3.3% index weight. Income, only 1.4%. And the last one, NVIDIA, 2.6%. In the index, only 1% of income contribution. So, Matt, which of those five, and hopefully I said the numbers here where they could be processed, would seem to be a company that would have more logic of ownership just based on those two things?
Well, I'm a business owner, right? And so I want a company whose valuation and their actual real what's going out to be together. Not your valuation is here, but you're really not contributing here. That doesn't make any sense
I
at all.
Man,
that's just crazy talk, right? So it's Google, right? Yeah. I mean, it's Alphabet, right? That's very, very, very clear.
Correct.
And maybe it's because you guys have been brainwashing me for the last 3 years about wanting this ultimate clarity, but that math just makes sense, yeah. Chuck.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
All
you got
valuation
it.
Valuation metrics, right? The valuation of Google is below, obviously, the rest of these names, which means that you have the potential for expansion of your multiple, which is one of the reasons why you invest in business for multiple expansion.
Boy, how do you like that, Mark? Matt, that was good. That was not rehearsed. Well done, my friend. I wanted to answer another one of Matt's questions here because I want you to speak to this too, because Matt brought up that question about, hey, when this phenomenon basically ends, which it usually does, right? What happens to some of these big companies, number one? And then number two, where does the sources of return following this occur? So two things here. So I'm going to give you some stats here. Before a company, this is going back to 1927. So before a company joined the top 10, 10 years before, it averaged 10% a year, pretty decent. 5 years before, 19.1. 3 years before, 24.2. Now, at the start of the first calendar year, right, after joining the 10, the next 3 years, 0.7. The next 5 years, negative 0.6. And the 10 years after that, negative 1.5. So, Mark, we do have a little bit of history, and you got on it here in the year 2000. And I'm not suggesting this is going to turn out to that, but we all remember what happened, right? We had the tech blow up, but we had a transfer of value. International started to look appealing. Small and mid picked up the slack. There's right. always great companies to own, right? So speak a little to this, if you would,
well,
please.
First of all, what these stats tell is you don't want to own the companies in the top 10. You want to own the companies you think that are going to go in the top 10. So by the time the top 10 is there, you're pretty much late for the game. And if Precisely. You look at Microsoft and its performance, you yes. would see that for 10 to 15 years, that was a dead stock.
It dead money from 2000 to about 2014. Right. You got it.
Intel, Cisco Systems, dead money. These were big. These were in the top 10 of the S&P. Some of those names aren't even there anymore. MCI WorldCom was in the top 10.
GE, Oklahoma, right? General Electric.
GE.
Yeah.
These were all in the top 10 back there. They're not, two of them aren't even around anymore.
Right.
GE had to go through a massive rebuilding. And so the moral of the story is, hey, it's great that these 10 names have helped the S&P short term, but the reality is that more than likely 5 to 7 of those names will have very little impact on this index in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, could it be different? Sure, it could be different, but I argue that there are other companies that are going to move into that position, and you want to own those companies that will do that. And this is one of, I mean, there's multiple reasons why we own Google, but Google, of those top five tech names, by far is the least expensive, has the lowest PEG ratio, right. has the lowest ratios in general, and this, of course, is not a recommendation to go buy Google because we did buy it lower than it is today. But the point of the story is that valuations eventually do matter. And I just think that the message or the moral of this story is once you're in the top five, you're too late. You should have owned it 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 years ago, not today, which means if you're in the S&P, you're owning them now. And you better hope that the next 5 to 10 companies sitting in there in the S&P are going to be the ones that are going to move into that situation.
So sweet. And did it lead me into the last part here, because I always love this. I learned this from you. We quote price earnings ratios all the time. And your answer typically is it's relative. And then, of course, that's open end and it's relative to a lot of things, which I want you to get into. But I'm going to give our listeners a couple of numbers here and then spin it back to you and we can close this out. So as of today, these would be forward numbers, Mark. As of today, the forward 12-month PE on the market cap weighted S&P 500 is about 18.8. So just to give again our listeners, typically it's 16. So if you use that metric, you can just say, alone in a vacuum, pricey. Now, here's the one that I really want you to get to. If you strip out big tech, which again would be those companies that we just mentioned, the PE ratio on the remainder of the 495 stocks on a forward basis is 13.2. I think when we run ours, it's even less than that. Speak to just the opportunities that are out there. in part because of what AI is going to do. We talked about that, but just the transformation of thinking that it takes to look business by business, as opposed to just this market view of an index, which actually is the conundrum we're getting at. So take it away, bud.
Yeah, that's the power of transparency and flexibility. That's the power of the opportunity to take advantage of businesses that are on sale. I mean, you look at a name like Amgen at 12 times earnings with almost a 4% dividend yield, Bristol Myers, 8 times earnings with a 3.5% dividend yield, Cigna, healthcare, financials, and energy. Devon Energy just got upgraded yesterday. Devon Energy is at about 7 times earnings with a 10% dividend yield. The problem that many investors have is that they are into immediate gratification. They think that they should see an immediate return on their investment. And we always say it's time in an investment, not timing an investment. Business owners take a long-term viewpoint of the investments that they make in their business. If they make a great return in the short term, that's great. I mean, that's icing on the cake. But the reality is that business owners, when they make investment in their business, it's slow and steady wins the race, which means that when the value of your businesses are trading at a historical discount to what they normally would be, that is the time to buy them and not chase the shiny stuff. But investors, number one, either chase the shiny stuff or they don't know what they own and why they own it. And so they go and they buy an index because they hope that they're chasing the shiny stuff. And that's not what a smart business owner does. A smart business owner, which is what you are when you invest in companies in the stock market, is they like to buy stuff on sale. That is the object, and be a long-term thinker in that process.
Clarity overrides the conundrum. So thanks big time, Mark. And Matt, if you would close us out, my friend,
absolutely,
we would appreciate it.
So here's my quick synopsis of everything that was just said. The information that's being presented to you at these, you know, almost sports-like play-by-play numbers at the end of every single solitary day isn't actually the reality of what's going on in the greatest place to buy and sell businesses that have ever been created, to quote Mark Pearson. So the other thing too is, if you don't have the clarity, and if you're just owning something for the sake of owning it because somebody told you to, instead of really truly knowing what you own and why you own it, you're missing the entire point of not only this podcast, which is Investing with Clarity, but also what it truly means to be an investor. So for Chuck and Mark, this is Matt Haller, and we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
The content discussed is for informational purposes only. It is not a solicitation or recommendation for any securities that may be mentioned herein. Advisory services offered through Nepsis, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor.